Welcome to the Deep Dive. Here, we tackle complex sources, pull out the core insights, basically making you instantly informed.
Think of it as getting straight to the good stuff.
Exactly. We aim for those aha moments, you know, cutting through the jargon so you really grasp things without feeling swamped.
And today we're diving into something pretty fascinating. Stochastic partial differential equations, SPDEs.
Right, SPDEs. Specifically, we're looking at when their solutions start behaving, well, maybe predictably isn't the right word.
Statistically predictable, perhaps. We're talking about central limit theorems for these SPDEs.
Okay, central limit theorems. That sounds quite mathematical.
It is, but the core idea isn't that scary. It's really about finding familiar patterns in what looks like randomness. We'll see how these complex solutions can, under the right conditions, start looking like a bell curve when you average them out.
Interesting. And our source for this is the paper Central Limit Theorems for Parabolic Stochastic Partial Differential Equations by Chen, Khoshnazan, Newellart, and Poole. That's the one. So our mission here, for you listening, is to figure out the main takeaways. When and how do solutions to a certain type of SPDE start looking normally distributed, especially when averaged over large spaces?
Yep, that's the goal.
Okay, let's jump in then. What kind of SPDE are we actually dealing with here?
So we're looking at a D-dimensional nonlinear stochastic heat equation.
Heat equation.
Yeah.
Okay, I know that one. Describes heat spreading out, but stochastic.
Right. Imagine heat flow, but the environment itself is randomly fluctuating. That's the stochastic part. It comes from noise, specifically Gaussian noise.
Gaussian, like the bell curve again.
Exactly. And it's white in time, which basically means the noise at one moment is independent of the noise at any other moment.
No memory.
Correct. And spatially, the noise isn't just random everywhere. It has a structure, a spatial correlation structure defined by a finite Borel measure. Let's call it F.
Okay, F. And there was a condition too, DeLange's condition.
Yes, F has to satisfy DeLange's condition. Think of it as a technical requirement. It ensures the noise isn't so intense or correlated in a specific way that the whole equation breaks down. It guarantees we actually get a well-defined solution, what we call a mild solution.
Got it. So a heat equation, random noise with structure F, satisfying DeLange's condition. What about the starting point, the initial state?
Ah, yes. The initial condition is simple. U0, x equals 1, everywhere.
So like a perfectly uniform temperature across the whole space to begin with.
Exactly. A flat start.
All right. What are the key pieces in the equation itself that make it tick?
Well, you've got the Laplacian. That's the standard diffusion part, how the heat spreads.
Okay.
Then there's a function multiplying the noise term, Ea. This can be nonlinear.
Meaning the effect of the noise might depend on the current temperature in a non-simple way.
Precisely. And is Lipschitz continuous, basically? Its slope is bounded. It can't change infinitely fast. Oh, and importantly, we need 1 to be non-zero.
Why is that important?
Well, since we start at U1, if someone was 0, the noise wouldn't have any effect initially. The system wouldn't feel the randomness right away. So sino-0 ensures the noise kicks in from the start.
Makes sense. And the noise itself, you mentioned its spatial structure is governed by F. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. So E is a random field, zero mean, instantaneous correlation in time, like we said. Spatially, F tells you how related the noise values are at different points. If F puts more weight near the origin, it means nearby points are more strongly correlated.
And DeLange's condition, again, intuitively, it stops this correlation being too strong.
Kind of. It's a specific integral condition on the Fourier transform of F. It essentially limits how much energy the noise has at high spatial frequencies, preventing the solution from blowing up. It's necessary for the existence theory.
Okay, so we have this well-defined SPDE. Now, what about its behavior over time and space? The paper mentions ergodic properties.
Right. In a companion paper, the author showed some interesting things about the solution, USX, viewed as a random field in space for any fixed time T0.
Like what?
First, it's stationary, meaning its statistical properties look the same everywhere in space. Shift your view, the stats don't change.
Okay.
Second, it can be ergodic. That means spatial averages converge to the overall statistical average. This happens if a condition on the Fourier transform of Foltz holds, basically meaning the correlations decay enough at large distances.
And mixing, I saw that mentioned too.
Yeah, mixing is a stronger property. It implies that regions far apart become statistically independent. They found conditions for mixing too, related again to the decay of correlations.
So if the solution is mixing, meaning distant parts become independent, doesn't that automatically suggest a central limit theorem when you average over large regions? Like, you're just adding up lots of nearly independent things.
You'd think so. That's often the case. People use what are called mixing and blocking arguments. You divide space into big blocks that are almost independent because of mixing, and then you apply CLT arguments.
But not here.
But not quite here. It turns out that for this specific SPDE, even with mixing, those standard arguments didn't work. The dependent structure was still too tricky. They needed new methods.
Okay. So standard tools weren't enough. This is where it gets interesting. What was their approach then? How did they get the CLTs?
They introduced something called occupation fields. It's a neat idea.
Occupation fields?
Yeah. Imagine you take the solution at some time t. You apply a function g to it. Maybe you square it. Maybe you just take u itself. Then you average this gut over a large spatial region.
How large?
Well, the size is controlled by a parameter, say n, and you might use a weighting function, g and x, to define how you average over this region of size n. This whole averaged quantity is the occupation field, sntg.
So it captures the average behavior of some function g of the solution over a big box of size n.
Basically, yes. It lets them probe the solution statistics on large scales.
And what did they find out about these SNT things?
This is the main punchline, theorem 1.1. They found that if the total mass of that spatial correlation measure F is finite, so 0FRD.
Meaning the overall amount of spatial correlation is limited.
Exactly. If that condition holds, then if you take the occupation field, scale it properly by ND2, and use a simple averaging function like the indicator of a cube 0, 1D scaled up by N, this scaled average converges in distribution to a normal distribution, a standard bell curve centered at zero as the size of your averaging region n goes to infinity.
Wow. So even with the nonlinearity and the noise, averaging over large enough scales brings out the bell curve if the total noise correlation FURD is finite.
Precisely. It's a beautiful result. Yeah. And they also showed, interestingly, that if Celes is just a constant, so the nonlinearity is simple, then the CLT holds if and only if FOCR is finite. The condition is sharp in that case.
That condition, FMRD, really is like the secret sauce here.
It absolutely is. It controls the long-range dependence in a crucial way. Proving theorem 1.1 directly was hard, though. So they actually developed more powerful tools, functional central limit theorems.
Functional CLTs. Okay, unpack that for us. What's the difference?
A regular CLT, like theorem 1.1, tells you about one specific averaged quantity converging to a single normal random variable. A functional CLT tells you about a whole collection or process of these averages converging simultaneously to a Gaussian random field or process.
So instead of one number becoming Gaussian, it's like a whole function's worth of numbers becoming a Gaussian function.
Sort of, yeah. Think about varying the averaging function or the observation function g. A functional CLT describes how the occupation fields behave jointly as you vary these functions within certain families. To get there, they first needed some technical bounds controlling how large these occupation fields can get. That's theorem 2.1. These bounds involve DeLange's condition implicitly through a function would.
And the main functional results are theorems 2.3 and 2.4.
Correct. Theorem 2.3 looks at what happens when you vary the averaging function. If you let range over a nice, compact set F of functions, think of a well-behaved family of shapes you average over, then the whole collection, ND2, SNT4 in F, converges to a centered Gaussian random field. Let's call it T.
Okay. And theorem 2.4.
That one does something similar, but fixes the averaging shape and instead varies the observation function g over a compact set g of Lipschitz functions. Again, the collection nd2 sng for g in g converges to the same limiting Gaussian field t.
And this limiting field t, it has some structure, its correlations.
Yes, its covariance structure is described by something called a bilinear form, btgg, which depends on the original function g, or two functions if you look at covariance between different g's, and the time t.
Can you give a concrete example of these sets, f or g? It sounds a bit abstract.
Sure. For f, the set of averaging functions, you could take all indicator functions of cube 0 md, where m is less than some maximum size m. Theorem 2.3 would then tell you that the spatial averages over all these different size cubes, when scaled, converge jointly to something like a multidimensional Brownian motion, often called a Brownian sheet.
Ah, okay. I could picture that. And for g, the observation function.
For g, you might take, say, all functions gu o plus b, where the slope a and intercept b are within some bounded ranges, or maybe functions like gu o p is o for a sin in some interval. Theorem 2.4 says the averages involving any of these functions within the set G will converge together to that Gaussian field tier. It shows the result is robust to how you're looking at the solution as long as it's within a reasonable family.
Very powerful. Now, the paper also talks about short-range dependence. How does that fit in?
Right, that's lemma 5.1. Short-range dependence basically means the statistical connection between GUTX and GUT drops off quickly as the distance between X and Y increases. They show that if our key condition holds SRD, then the spatial field, GUT, is short-range dependent for any Lipschitz G.
And why is that important for the CLT?
Because it provides the justification for why averaging works. If the field is short-range dependent, then when you average over a huge region, the contributions from distant subregions are almost independent. It's this effective independence that underlies the central limit theorem. Proposition 5.2 then connects the short-range dependence to the actual variance of the limiting Gaussian field. It shows the variance is related to this bilinear form BTGG.
Okay, so finite F implies short-range dependence, which helps the CLT work.
Yeah.
Does the limiting Gaussian thingy T always have actual randomness? Or can it sometimes just be zero?
Good question. Proposition 5.3 tackles at the non-degeneracy. It gives conditions on the non-linearity scut that ensure the limiting variance. BTGG is actually positive for some G. For example, if so is always positive or always negative when its argument is positive, or if so u is zero but behaves in a certain way near zero, like behaves like sine, then you can guarantee the limit it isn't just trivially zero. It has real variance.
Got it. One last concept mentioned was asymptotic independence. What's that about?
That's theorem 6.2. It looks at two different occupation fields. Imagine calculating one average SNT using a function localized in one part of space and another average using a function localized in a completely separate, disjoint region.
Okay, two averages over regions far apart.
Exactly. The theorem says that as the overall scale n goes to infinity, these two averages become statistically independent. Fluctuations in one region become decoupled from fluctuations in a distant region in the large-scale limit. It reinforces this idea of statistical regularity emerging at large scales.
Okay, so let's try to pull this all together. This deep dive seems to show that for these complex SPDEs, if you look at spatial averages.
Right, if you average the solution or some function of it over large enough regions.
Then the randomness starts to smooth out, and you see this familiar bell curve, this normal distribution, emerge.
Provided, and this is the key condition, that the total spatial correlation of the underlying noise, measured by the total mass of F, is finite.
That finite mass condition, FRD, seems to be the linchpin for everything.
It really is. It controls the long-range dependencies just enough to allow the averaging process to work its magic and lead to Gaussian fluctuations. It's the bridge between the microscopic randomness and the macroscopic statistical regularity.
So for you listening, what's the big aha moment here?
I think it's precisely that connection, the link between a property of the noise, its total spatial correlation being finite, and the emergence of this universal statistical behavior, the Gaussian distribution, when you look at large spatial scales. It tells us something fundamental about how complexity can average out.
And the functional CLTs really take that a step further, showing this isn't just about one specific average, but holds for whole families of averages and observation functions.
Absolutely. They paint a much richer picture. It's not just one number becoming Gaussian. It's this whole landscape of statistical fluctuations that behaves in a coherent Gaussian way.
Really fascinating stuff. If someone's interest is piqued, where could they go next? What are the open questions?
Oh, several interesting paths. A big one is, what happens if FRT is infinite? When the noise has truly long-range correlations, do you still get CLTs? If so, what do they look like? Are they non-Gaussian, perhaps?
So exploring different noise structures.
Exactly. Another direction is different initial conditions. We started at UA1 everywhere. What if you start with something else? And of course, for the mathematically inclined, digging into the proof techniques Melyavin calculus, Poincaré inequalities that underpin these results would be very rewarding.
Right, the machinery behind it all. Okay, let's end with a thought to chew on. How might these theoretical results, you know, about SPDEs and CLTs actually connect to the real world?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Could they help us understand or model phenomena where we see randomness and spatial structure?
Mm.
Maybe things like, I don't know, pollutant dispersal in the air, or maybe even financial market fluctuations.
Potentially, yes. Think about any system described by diffusion-like processes affected by widespread random influences. These results suggest that even if the microscopic details are incredibly complex and random, the aggregate behavior, the stuff we measure over larger regions or longer times, might exhibit these simpler Gaussian statistical patterns.
So looking at the big picture might reveal surprising regularity, even when the small scale is chaotic.
That's the hope. And that's what these theorems mathematically demonstrate for this class of equations. It gives us a hint about where to look for predictable patterns in complex systems.
A very compelling thought. Well, thank you for taking us through that. It's been a really insightful deep dive into SPDEs and central limit theorems.
My pleasure. It's a rich area of research.
Indeed. And thank you, our listener, for joining us.